Dan Gardner was going to be here for Senate Bill 92, and he's got a meeting at 12:30. He said he'd get here as soon as we could, so we'll move on down the line here a little bit and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 206. Dennis.
Senate Bill 206 implements a client trust account overdraft notification program for real estate licensees, reconciles discrepancies in current statutes, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact statement has been issued.
Okay. Scott, are you ready to come up and do some testifying? Welcome. It's been a long time since I've seen you.
It has.
Yeah. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 206. This bill primarily is some housekeeping changes. As you may remember, last session, the Real Estate Agency, in concert with the Oregon Association of Realtors, introduced legislation which dramatically changed our law. And as we implemented that law, we became aware that there were a few things that we missed. And so we have attempted to fix those. Probably the biggest one has to do with those licensees that are transitioning from salesperson to broker. There are two things in that old bill. It talks about effective dates and operative dates, and the intent was to give those folks 3 years from the time the bill became operative, which was July 1, 2002, and it actually gave them 3 years from the time it became effective, which was January 1, 2002, so we cut them short by 6 months. So we're fixing that and some other minor issues. There is another issue there which was mentioned, which deals with the trust account overdraft notification program. This particular program is modeled after the Oregon State Bar, whereby the agency would enter into an agreement with a financial institution, and when a check in a broker or property manager's client's trust account was presented to the bank and it was non-sufficient funds, that that institution would notify the agency. Now, why is that important? It's important in that those trust funds are client's trust funds. They are not the broker or the property manager's funds. Over the past several years, we've seen some real problems, primarily with property managers, concerning losses to the public, where we believe that this type of a notification would have gotten the agency in there early, and we could have either prevented or severely limited the losses that the public suffered as a result of the shortages in those clients' trust accounts. And finally, there is a amendment, Senate Bill 206-1, which I believe you have, makes some additional changes, corrects some typographical errors, and it does two other things. There have been two appellate cases that have happened since last session. One is Dearborn versus the Real Estate Agency. The second is Curley versus the Real Estate Agency, which affect what it is that the agency can do in terms of disciplining its licensees, or what we can do in terms of either approving or disapproving an application for licensing. The Dearborn case I won't go into, but the essence of it suggested that there may be some things that affect how somebody conducts their business related to their trustworthiness that the agency at this point can't address, so the changes have been made to address that. The Curley case addressed the situation. This, incidentally, has been accepted for review by the Supreme Court, but it addresses situations where someone may have done something prior to licensing that affected their trustworthiness to engage in the real estate business. And the upshot of that case, quoting Dearborn, which was the first case, was that we couldn't consider those issues. So, again, some changes have been made to resolve that. And finally, in the Dash Amendment, is a recommendation from the Real Estate Board. Again, it was something that was left out of Senate Bill 446 relative to who they can consider in terms of granting waivers of time experience.
You heard the comment on the Supreme Court case. They're undertaking some of the interpretation of the statute. How will this amendment, will that affect that case? Will it render it moot or anything like that?
I don't think it renders, Mr. Chair, I don't think it renders it moot. I think what it does is better clarify what we can do. If you look at ORS 696-301-27, I believe it is, which is the section of the statute that addresses things that people have done of a criminal nature that affects the trustworthiness to engage in real estate, there is a word substantial in there which we have removed. And from our reading of the decision, by removing that substantial, it removes the burden down to one that's still fairly narrow in that it has to relate to their real estate activity, but it reduces it from this substantial nexus down to a nexus, which we think we can work with.
What was that site again? Was,
as I recall, it's 696-301 sub 27.
301 sub 27. All right, sounds good. There was a bill last session, and this is a fix of that. Could you explain again the outcome of some of the changes from what the last session actually did, and what's been the practical result again?
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure I understand your question correctly. What you're interested in is what the bill last session did.
And what has been the effect of that bill?
Okay. The bill last session rewrote and modernized our statute. One of the things that did as a result of that rewrite, it did two big things. First is it eliminated the salesperson's category of license, leaving us with only brokers, increased some pre-licensing education, some other things like that. Second is it changed the agency disclosure section of the statute fairly significantly from what it had been in the past. I think it gives better disclosure to the public, for one, and I think it makes it easier for the licensees to abide by, for two. Because of those changes, and they were so massive through the statute, there were a few things we missed. I mentioned the one regarding the time period for the transitioning salespeople. There was another in the agency section where, when you read the new law, it was unclear which of those obligations applied to clients, which obligations applied to everybody, and that's been clarified, for example, in this bill.
Okay.
It's little things like that.
How are the realtors reacting to this change? And
we've been in constant communication with them ever since the legislative concept was drafted, which I believe was in May. As far as I know, they have signed on to everything. I think they have no position as far, I can't speak for them, but my understanding is they don't have a position as far as the overdraft notification program, primarily because they hadn't had time to take it to their membership.
Oh, okay. Yes. I'm also understanding that there was a task force that was put together to, is it on this bill, or is it just relationships between the agency and the realtors, or how does it affect this bill?
Oh, the task force, well, there's an advisory group that is being put together relative to how the agency does its investigative work and its sanctioning.
Okay.
Really, that has nothing to do with this bill.
Has nothing to do with this bill.
No.
It's not even put together yet.
No, it's in the process of being put together.
Okay, and then I had one last question here on the on the second page of this written statement, again, in opposition, there's none. However, financial institutions have not commented on Section 14. Did you anticipate that's going to cause any problems?
We mentioned that, Mr. Chairman, because apparently when the bar amended their statute some years ago, I believe it was 1995, the financial statements or the institutions may have had opposition at that time. Now, that particular law has been implemented for a number of years now, and it could be that because this is so similar, they don't have. I simply don't know.
Okay, well, that's something we probably better look at to make sure. We're doing now. See, these proposed amendments, they're not in amendment form yet. They're not in a dash amendment form. I just, the ones I have are. Do you have any of those?
I think Jess has the only one.
No, I can't chop that up. Okay, any questions from the committee? About any of this?
Seems like anybody agrees.
Okay, well, we, I mean, there's a few questions here, so I think what I'll do, Scott, I just close the public hearing and we'll check on the financial institutions thing and just get some more information and then we'll check some more on these amendments and move forward from there. So that's fine with everybody.
Nobody else wants to testify now.
I don't know, does anybody else want to testify? Is any?
They're all here.
The realtors? Okay. All right, well, we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill, what is this one? 206. And the state will check on some of these things, financial institutions, and then move forward from that. Okay. Very good. Well, I see the commissioner is back there, so we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 92. Dennis.
Senate Bill 92 creates exemption from civil penalty for a minor employed by corporation whose parent or guardian or sole shareholder or unincorporated association whose parent or guardian or only member. Exemption applicable when both parents are only shareholders of corporation or only members of unincorporated association. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
All right. Well, we have the good commissioner in front of us. How are you doing? Introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome.
Chair. Senator Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, recovering legislator. But anyway, I'm here today on Senate Bill 92, and before you, you have a couple of items. One is a letter from me simply stating how we currently deal with the situation and that under current administrative rules, it is clearly defined what someone standing in the place of a parent is, and it is our current interpretation, but I'm wholeheartedly in support of the bill as a whole because it does codify into state law what we currently do through administrative rules. Attached to, that letter is also what the current federal law is on it, as well as our field operations manual from the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which simply explains what a person standing in the place of a parent is. And the basic interpretation, to put it simply, is that someone who's standing in the place of a parent must take financial obligation of that individual, such as bringing them into their home and being responsible for their education, etc. And that clearly defines what person standing in the place of a parent is and would fit within the current bill as it's written.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify that the commissioner did say they support the bill.
It's Senator, it is in writing on the back side of that first page. The word support is clearly written there. I could probably send another copy bolded and underlined if it would be of benefit to the committee.
No. Okay, so just want to make sure that's what I heard.
This is basically administrative rules you've been operating under this. This is the attempt to codify what you've been doing under administrative rules.
Absolutely.
Actually, got that,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The good commissioner is a recovering legislator. He hasn't figured out how to say all of this in two paragraphs. So.
But he did put it on one page.
Yeah.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it's the side benefit or detraction of having too many attorneys around me, I believe.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
May I speak to the bill briefly as bill is sponsored by my request? And this bill is brought forward by a constituent who came forward who has a owner of a construction company was prohibited from employing his own minor children because of the nature of the company. It was a construction company. And I had to check. I grabbed the wrong statute book, but there's a 653.370. Is that the statute dealing with construction?
Well, actually, if you turn to the back of the first page of the handout, we'll go to the U.S. Department of Labor, and it talks about those that are exemptions. And it clearly says under the federal statute, it says by parenthetic phrases, including sections 311 of the Act, a parent or person placed standing in the place of a parent may employ his own child or a child in his custody under the age of 16 in any occupation other than the following: manufacturing, mining, and an occupation found by the secretary to be particularly hazardous or detrimental to the health or well-being of a child between the ages of 16 and 18. So my understanding of construction is under the federal statute that already does fall into that, and there is nothing in state statute that we can do to allow a minor child to work in the field of construction, Senator.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, construction is considered to be an occupation found by the Secretary to be particularly hazardous or detrimental to the health?
I can get you an answer back in writing, but that is my current understanding today, yes.
Okay, so and under that scenario, this bill, it may be good to define this in statute anyway, if that's what the practice is, but mm-hmm. if it's a federal rule, obviously this bill won't alleviate the concerns of my constituent, but... because that's what prompted this bill was specifically a construction of an industry.
So what you're really saying is this bill, as it is, would not cover your constituent then?
Well, not if it's a federal law, apparently.
Yes. That's my understanding, Senator Nelson. I'd be happy to bring the head of the Wage and Hour Division with me to meet with Senator Byer and see if we can look at his concern in his particular situation and see what can or cannot be done in the situation.
Just want to clarify here the discussion. So where it says, what you just read, Commissioner, was that they may employ other than manufacturing, mining, or an occupation found to be hazardous or detrimental. So where is the language of construction being?
That would be under the hazardous and or detrimental.
I know, but is that in here somewhere?
It doesn't specifically state it. What I was testifying to, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, is that it is my understanding that construction is and has for a number of years fallen under that particular exemption. That it's found to be hazardous, therefore a minor child under the age of 16 cannot, under federal rules and regulations, be allowed to work in that particular profession.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
is that rule enforced by your office, or is that enforced at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that rule is enforced by our office through the Wage and Hour Division that has a child labor unit board that provides those exemptions that are applied for through those. But, yeah, we do the local enforcement of that, Senator.
Okay.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm just confused here, so I'm sure it's my fault. But, I'm just reading this, the web thing. That on the front page. Do you have this, Commissioner?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where it says the labor has found the following non-ag occupations hazardous. And I'm just reading through the list. And I don't see construction there. So I'm just confused as to where that comes from. I mean, it's not on their list.
It's it has in this particular page, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger.
There's more pages?
It does not specifically list that. It does list power tools, etc., in that. All I was testifying to, Mr. Chair, is it's my understanding that construction also falls within that in my given experience and vast 6 weeks' experience as commissioner. But anyway, I'd be happy, as I said, to sit down with Senator Beyer and work through the particular type of construction that he is talking about and see if that fits within the federal or state standards as well.
Yeah, I think that would be good, Mr. Chair. I mean, there may be something here for the issue that Senator Beyer's constituent has brought up. I mean, I think it would be important to see what flexibility there might be that we might have here, because it doesn't seem to just grab me that that is necessarily prohibited.
Mr. Chair, I would have to agree with Senator Metzger. That's why I was trying to find out if this construction was an interpretation that you have made as a your office. And let me get this, let me be very clear. Obviously, it wasn't your office when when this happened.
Yeah.
It was the previous administration. But at the same time, I mean, that's what I'm trying to find out also. Is it is it something that the BOLI at the state level determined that construction is a hazardous job and that's why it's on this list, or something came from the feds, or that's... But at any rate, it sounds like the statute may do... The statute change may be necessary to conform agency rules to statute, which I hate to do. It seems like it's supposed to be the other way around, as I've said before in this committee, that we're supposed to make the statutes and they're supposed to follow them. We're not supposed to conform our statute to fit their rules.
Right. Well, to Mr. Chair, and just to follow up on that, it's possible, as the commissioner and senator look into this, that there are, as you mentioned, you know, power tools, or here it says power-driven woodworking machines, mm-hmm. or roofing, that there may be certain prohibitions within what we call construction, but there may be certain activities within the broad scheme of construction that could be allowed, and where maybe a child, working with the family could do certain things. Within a narrower definition, but you know, couldn't say do roofing or operate power tools or something, and at least provide some flexibility, perhaps.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger would be happy to look into the history of that and work with him, and I'd be happy to work with Senator Beyer on the particular case involved. If, in fact, it was an interpretation from the Bureau of Labor and Industries on a specific case, I'd be happy to review that case with the senator and work with him to see what we can do.
Great.
Okay, good. All right, well, we'll close the public hearing. And is anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? No, I don't see anybody. And we'll just close the public hearing, and we won't go into a work session. We'll see if we can get some more information. Close the public.
Get it there.
It was empty.
I never seen it move so fast.
That was good. All right, we have one more.
We run every day down the hall.
One more bill. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 250. Mr. Dodson, sir.
Senate Bill 250 authorizes state agencies to utilize performance reporting information system to measure workforce performance.
All right. Well, this is a bill we had before. Graham, please come back up. You're getting to be a regular.
Prison system again?
This is the prison.
My weekly visit.
Please introduce yourself and welcome again. And
thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Graham Slater with the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. Coming back this week just to answer, I think, maybe the one remaining question. Just as a reminder, this bill would start the process of shutting down that old shared information system, put in place the performance reporting information system, which is PRISM, and allow greater flexibility for PRISM. Just two main things we want to tell you this afternoon. One, we do want to correct the testimony from last week, and that is that when we gave you the table of which agencies had general fund, which had used general fund for their PRISM contributions, the Department of Education was in fact 100% federal. So that takes them effectively out of this discussion of general fund being used. And again, that's a correction from last week. And then the most important is one of the headers on your written testimony there, that our budget folks have worked with budget staff in the Department of Human Services, and I can tell you today that all four of those agencies who are the PRISM participants have committed not to use general funds for any kind of PRISM support or funding during the coming biennium. Three of the agencies, ourselves, community colleges, and Department of Education, weren't using general fund already, so that's not an issue. And then Department of Human Resources, or Human Services, services, they have two program areas that participate, vocational services and children and families. And they were basically using between 21% and 30%, each of them was a different percent, to support PRISM because they needed to do that under federal matching requirements. And I don't know all the details on that, but their rules when they get the federal money, a certain amount of state money has to be matched to it. And with our budget folks and theirs talking this through, certainly even as late as Monday of this week, there's been an agreement that because we use other funds, non-federal funds, as part of our support for PRISM, that can be used to meet the matching requirement because it's all one project. So there are non-federal funds being used. And at that point, DHS was very content not to use any general funds at all. They were doing it simply to meet the matching requirements. So that's kind of where we are. Just to summarize again, as I've kind of expressed to you, we do think PRISM or CIS, but PRISM will be better, has a great value. I think Senator Metzger last time talked about it, that it is our only way to know whether all of these different programs actually put people in jobs and their wages go up and so on. We try to address your concerns on the general fund, and we certainly understand them given the economy that we also report on. So at this point, we continue to ask your support for Senate Bill 250. We think it's the best thing to do to run these programs efficiently and sunset the one and move to the other. Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Just another clarification. We got a letter here from the Commissioner Dan Gardner, who just left, but says that they use PRISM, and I'm wondering why they're not paying, I guess.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Senator Bayer, the Bureau of Labor and Industries has participated in the Shared Information System in CIS, and at this point they're one of the agencies that we're planning, in, and that's part of that flexibility under number three of our goals here, okay. One of the agencies that we want to be able to bring into PRISM.
Okay.
Currently they're not.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions, any other concerns? I think one of the things we should bring to the record is that if it's billed as a pass, and you're actually going to support both systems. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct under the current statute, yeah. And that's never been our plan.
So. Okay. Well, I guess we made something.
Not a good idea.
Right.
Of general funds, how much savings would there be in general funds? Just do you have any idea?
From making this change for Department of Human Services?
Yeah.
Roughly 20,000.
20,000.
Because, yeah.
Well, that's it.
Right.
Well, we can take... Senator Byer can take some credit for that.
He should.
That's good. All right. Any
$1,000 a month.
Okay. Any further questions? Any other concerns? We'll intend to close the public hearing and then go into a work session. So, any other folks who want to testify? All right. We'll close the public hearing. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 250. Did you say you moved this?
Yeah, I said finally we have a work session on this bill.
Yeah. You want to move it to the...
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
There's an amendment.
There is an amendment, however. The dash one. That one, yes. I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 250.
All right, Senator Walker has moved dash one amendments to Senate Bill 250. Any comments, discussions? Any objections? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 250 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 250 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And any objections from any of the committee members?
Mr. Chair, I would like the bill not to be on the consent calendar. I think it needs to be spoken to that the agencies have agreed not to use general funds in their use of the bills or in the use of the system. We need to put that on the record.
Okay, so we'll just move it to the floor and do pass recommendation, not under the consent calendar.
And I think Senator Byer should carry it because he's the one who is so persistent and really saved the state of Oregon some money and should get some credit for that. So, how about it?
It hasn't passed yet.
Well, when it does pass.
Okay. If there are no objections to the motion, so moved, and Senate Bill 250 will be referred to the floor of the Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Oh.
And the suggestion has been that Senator Byer would carry this. Is this
It's not acceptable to Senator Byers asking me to carry it.
Would you like to? Well, Senator Walker will keep the, you know, we're keeping the things on an even keel here. Huh?
Okay.
Senator Walker will carry that bill.
So he can ask me some questions?
He can ask some questions, yeah. Thank you, folks, for your patience. And
thank you.
We had to work through the details. Appreciate it very much.
We had to hear your voice, not my voice.
Unless anything else before to come before the committee that we're.
Gosh, that's good timing.
All right. If not, we will
eat it, please.
Close the public hearing, and then we will be meeting against next work session. Better close the work session. Yep, thank you. And then we will close the public hearing, and we'll be meeting again next Monday at 1 o'clock.
What kind of bill do you have?
Well, I need.